So, thank you very much. It's fantastic to see so many people again. I obviously didn't manage to scare you off last time. I'll try better this time. Last time we're here, let's just do a quick bit of revision of what we were saying last time. Last time we were thinking, first of all, just about that relationship between science and religion in general. We saw that it's a really important question because it's one of the key issues that people raise in terms of choosing not to practice a religious faith. It's the main excuse that people give. It's the main excuse young people give. Science has disproved all of that. And hopefully what we've seen is that it's certainly not as simple as that. We looked at the myth of conflict between science and religion, and we saw that the conflict is really between science and biblical literalism. Obviously, if you take a very literal view of what the scriptures say, you are going to find differences between what modern science says and what the scriptures say, for instance, in terms of the age of the universe and how long it took to create it up to its present state. But I hope we also saw that, at least according to the teaching of the Catholic Church, according to some of the great saints of the past, and even in terms of the internal evidence in the Bible, biblical literalism looks like a mistake anyway. We saw that that was actually the real key issue as to why Galileo got into so much trouble. Copernicus, who was about 100 years before him, didn't really get into any serious trouble when he initially put forward the idea that the Earth orbits around the sun. It was Galileo who then started engaging in the theological questions of how we should interpret the Bible that got him into hot water. And again, it's important to say that the Catholic Church has since, rather too late, apologized for the way that it treated Galileo. We then looked at another way of getting things wrong that we hopefully will avoid, and that's the idea of the God of the gaps. The idea of saying that science explains most things, and the reason that you think you need God is because there are little bits, or large bits perhaps, that science can't yet explain, and you need God to fill in those gaps. And as science progresses, the gaps get smaller and smaller, and God gradually gets squeezed out. So that's another way I hope that we won't fall into the trap of doing. And then we finished up looking at a few texts of Scripture that hopefully pointed us in a more optimistic direction. Psalm 18, the heavens proclaim the glory of God. Or St. Paul in the letter to the Romans, ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And then we looked at what St. John said in the prologue to his gospel, seeing that, he said, everything is created through the word, through logos, through logic, through reason. And if we discover a world which is governed by beautiful scientific laws, beautiful reason, beautiful order, then perhaps that can also point us back to find the Logos who is God. So really what I want to do for this week and for next week is really to spend a long time seeing to what extent then can we try and make good an argument that says if we look at modern science, not only will we find that we shouldn't be religious, we will find it's not even just neutral, but I hope we'll find science furnishes us with very good reasons for believing in God. So that's sort of where I want to start. Arguments for the existence of God. What sorts of arguments are there? First of all, we can have cosmological arguments. They're the arguments that essentially go like this, based on our knowledge of the world or the universe, hence the term cosmological. And the argument basically goes like this. The world needs explaining. The world can't explain itself. Therefore, there's got to be something else that explains the world. And whatever the something else other than the world is, has to be something different from the world, in some way outside it, or above it, or beneath it, or before it. Our human words sort of run out of what the right preposition to use is, but somehow something distinct from the world that brings the world into existence, that explains why the world is here. And that's what I want to explore this week. Another way we can argue is the idea of design. And that argument goes something like this. The universe that we observe through science works amazingly well to produce wonderful things, things like you and me. We're all wonderful. So the universe isn't haphazard or chaotic. It brings forth things that are wonderful and meaningful. The laws of science explain that at some level. But on the other hand, we've got to ask, why do we have the particular laws of science that we have got in order to have a universe that brings forth such wonderful things? Because it doesn't have to be that way. So that would argue towards an idea that there's a designer God, a God who didn't just bring the universe into existence blindly, but brought the universe into existence in a deliberately chosen way for it to be full of meaning, for it to be full of life. And that's what I want to talk about next week. But there are other sorts of arguments for the existence of God, and let's just run through a few other ways we can do it. One's called the ontological argument, and that's the idea that you can argue that God exists from the very idea of what it means to be God. And St. Anselm was a great advocate of that sort of argument, but I'm going to completely leave that aside for the philosophers. For what it's worth, you're going to hate me for this, I don't think that argument works. But there we are, other people will disagree with me. We've got arguments as well from the human person. For instance, why is it that we think that every human person is infinitely valuable? Why is it that murdering people or enslaving people or human trafficking, why are those things so wrong? If we're simply super-evolved animals and nothing more, why should that be so wrong? Or what about our consciences? Why is it that we think that what we do is absolutely right or wrong, quite independently of whether we get found out? Even if you can be terribly naughty and get away with it, we still know it's wrong and we shouldn't do it. Why? What makes any sense of that? And what about the fact that so many people are religious? So many people have religious experiences. What can explain that? And then finally, from the claims of revelation, in particular, how do we make sense of what history says about Jesus? He claims to be God. That's not the sort of thing that an average sane person does on a Tuesday afternoon. You don't sort of mistake yourself for God unless you're suffering from mental illness. Some people suffering from mental illness do mistake themselves for God. Some people who are megalomaniacs might try and pretend they're God. But the famous argument goes, unless Jesus is mad or bad, and he claims to be God, well, maybe he's right. But all of those sorts of arguments are for another set of talks entirely. So I just sort of put them to you so that we can say they're there, and I'm not going to talk about them. But maybe in a few years' time, we'll have another series of talks and we'll look at some of those. Where do we want to go? The cosmological argument. Let's look at that in a little bit more detail. First of all, we're going to say that we observe things in the universe, we observe events in the universe, things that don't explain themselves. They need an explanation or a cause. And that's why we do science. If we looked at the world and we didn't think things provoked us with questions and saying, why is it that way? Why does that happen? Why does that exist? I want to find out. If those questions didn't strike us, we'd never have bothered to do science in the first place. But those questions do strike us. So therefore, we've got to conclude that the world, or at least the things in the world that we see, need explaining. Technically, we say they're contingent. What that means is that they are true, but they don't have to be true. They're not true in the same way that 2 plus 2 equals 4 has to be true. You can't imagine any other scenario. You can't imagine a scenario when 2 plus 2 equals 17, or 2 plus 2 equals 4 and a tiny little bit. 2 plus 2 is exactly 4, and that's it, end of story. It has to be true. But let's say the fact that you came here this evening is true, but it didn't have to be true. You could have stayed at home and watched the telly. But you chose to be here. So it's contingently true. And we'd want to ask you, why did you come? And you'd give us a reason, hopefully. And it wasn't just, there was so boring on the telly that I thought as well as come to this and it'd be slightly less boring than what was on telly. But you'd give us a reason. So when we look at the world and we see things are contingently true, our solar system has 8 planets. It didn't have to be 8. It could have been 14, or it could have been 1, or it could have been none at all. Why is it 8? There must be a reason. Something going on in this part of the space had to cause it. So contingent things need a cause, need a reason to make them true. 2 + 2 = 4 doesn't need a reason to make it true. It just is. But the fact that you came here this evening needs a reason. You needed to make a decision. You needed to get in your car and come. Now, sometimes when we see causes in the universe, we can trace them back step by step to previous causes. So if we can do that, you've then got to ask, well, what about the cause? Where did that come from? So, for instance, these tellies that you're looking at, why are they here? Because they were made in a factory. Good answer. But where did the factory come from? You've still got to ask that question. And if you get to, well, the factory was here for something else, well, then why did the person make the factory in the first place? And you've got to keep going and keep going and keep going. In the end, you've got to find a point when you stop and say there's a first cause, an ultimate cause. Let me give you an example. Supposing you drive up to a level crossing and you see a train going past, but the train was already going past when you got there, and you see a carriage, and then there's another one that's pulling along, and another one, and another one, and the last one goes by, but you didn't see the locomotive at the front. You know there's a locomotive at the front. Even if you didn't see it, it can't be any other way. The back carriage was being pulled by the carriage number 7, which was being pulled by carriage number 6, and so on all the way back. But it can't just be an endless chain of carriages all pulling themselves along without a locomotive right at the front. You need to get to a first cause. You need to get to something that can move, but doesn't need to be pulled along by something else. An uncaused cause. So we need to get to something that's above or outside the universe of contingent causes. Something a little bit like God. Ah, yes, that's all very well, but that idea is not without its difficulties, and we need to look at some of the difficulties. We need to look at them carefully. First of all, the idea of infinite regress. I know I've given you the example of a locomotive pulling along carriages on a train, but does that sort of analogy apply in every case? Can't you just have causes going back forever and ever and ever? It's the famous question of which came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, there's a chicken, and it came out of an egg. But that came out of a chicken, and that came out of an egg. And so on and so on. Is it impossible, even logically, that that could go back forever and ever and ever and ever? We know historically it didn't. We know chickens and eggs haven't been around that long. They've probably only been around for a few million years or so. So we know that chickens and eggs haven't actually gone back forever and ever. But is it logically impossible? And if they do go back for an ever and ever and ever, does that mean that you don't need God anymore? Well, let's think. Even if you've got an infinite chain of chickens and eggs, even if that infinite chain existed, does it have to exist? Or is it something that's just contingent? If it did exist, would we have to say, why does it exist? I think we do. If one chain, infinite chain of chickens and eggs, has to exist, why not two? or 749 infinite chains of chickens and eggs, or infinitely many chains of chickens and eggs? If an infinite chain just has to exist, why isn't the whole universe full of chickens and eggs? If one has to exist, why not thousands or millions? And if one chain of chickens and eggs has to exist, why not dragons and eggs? But yet I haven't seen any dragons around. So just because a chain can be thought of as infinite doesn't mean that it has to exist. It's still contingent. It needs a reason to exist. So it still needs some sort of cause, an ultimate cause. Not a first cause chronologically. I'm not saying that the chain has to go back and somewhere sort of over, you know, by the church over there, there's a picture of God. It doesn't matter how many arrows you've got, somewhere it's got to get back to God or a first cause. But if the chain is really infinite, it still needs a transcendent cause, something, as it were, outside the whole of that chain that causes the whole chain, even in its being infinitely long, causes the whole chain to exist. Or else not. It needs a reason why it exists. That one needs a little stopping off and thinking about. It's sort of one of those things that, you know, you really need to scratch your head hard and ponder for a long time. But I hope you can see, because there aren't any dragons around, you can imagine an infinite chain of dragons hatching out of eggs, hatching out of dragons, and so on. But the fact that you can imagine it going back forever and ever and ever, amen, doesn't mean it has to exist. If it did exist, there'd have to be a reason why it exists, a transcendent, ultimate cause. Next problem with the idea is, who made God? Classic schoolboy criticism of this sort of argument. But of course, actually to ask that question, when you think about it carefully, misses the point. The who made God argument imagines that we've sort of magicked up God as the solution to all of our problems. And then you've just got to say, well, you know, okay, where did God come from? That's not actually what we're doing. What we're doing is this. We're saying we see things that ultimately need to be explained. And once you admit that something ultimately needs to be explained, and it's actually here, then there must be an ultimate explanation of it, which must be out there somewhere as well. It's really the only choices we've got. Either you say this particular something doesn't in the end need to be explained, in which case stop doing science and stop doing all this philosophy and go have a nice cup of tea, or else it does need to be explained. And if it needs an ultimate explanation, there's got to be an ultimate explanation out there. And that's what we mean by God. At least this evening, that's what we mean by God. So there's all sorts of other things people believe about God that we'll have to come on to, some of them next time. Some of them we won't get onto at all in this series of talks. But at least as soon as we start saying things need explaining, somewhere there's got to be an ultimate explanation. And then finally, why is there something rather than nothing at all? If everything that exists needs a cause, what causes the everything? And there are three possibilities, I think. Either everything that exists is caused by something else. But that's a bit daft, because the something else that causes everything that exists has to be something that doesn't exist if it's not part of everything that exists. So you'd say that everything that exists is caused by something that doesn't exist. Bit of a problem there. Or everything that exists causes itself. But surely that's illogical as well. Nothing can cause itself. That's about like saying, you know, I'm my own father. No, I can't be my own father. I can't bring myself into existence. So I think the only possibility left is something exists which doesn't need to be caused. I think the logic there, when you think about it, is watertight. And even scientists agree that the universe has to be caused, that something just exists. Even atheist scientists agree that something just exists. It's just that they presume it's the universe or the laws of science that just exist, rather than something like God. But we'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, phew, what a lot of hard thinking. Let's move on. Let's come back to this question of arguments from science to God. And as I said, what I hope that we'll be able to see is not only is it that science is incompatible with God, but I hope we'll see that modern science points us right in the direction of God. That doesn't mean that God is part of our scientific inquiry of the world. As I said in answer to a question last week, we're not going to find God at the bottom of a test tube. We're not going to put God into our equations. We're going to be thinking philosophically about what we know through science. The arguments I want to put forward to you tonight are broadly cosmological in style. So the premises that we'll take is the world as we observe it, as we understand it, through modern science. And the working presumptions of the way that we do science. Those are going to be our premises. Now, you might want to disagree with the premises. You can disagree with the premises of any argument. But if you want to pick holes in science, that's fine for another day. But I'm trying to say that if you do science, you get to God. So I'm going to take science for granted. What I want to offer isn't going to be a knockdown proof. There are no knockdown proofs for God. If there were, we'd all believe in God by now. We'd have done it years and years and centuries ago. And these questions are intrinsically difficult. They take a lot of thinking out. Again, I'm not going to be offering you some sort of logical proof like we might do in mathematics, because we're not talking about mathematical things. We're talking about real things that exist out there. And for those, it's not logical arguments, sort of pure logical arguments that we need. What we need is a collection of data and a serious sifting of that data to work out what the right conclusions are. John Henry Newman actually pointed out that if we're going to do this sort of argument, what we rely on ultimately is a personal sense of being able to judge what all the collections of our data and evidence and so forth amount to. It calls for a personal, responsible evaluation of all the data we've got, all the evidence. That's just the way it has to be, because that's the way it is with anything that exists in the world. That's how you do it in a court of law. That's how you do it in science. You don't prove things logically in science. You go out and you make observations and you do experiments and you come up with theories and you evaluate, does my theory match my experiment or not? And the match is never perfect because there are always errors in your experiments. Is it good enough? Is there enough evidence to believe this or believe that? Is there enough evidence to believe in gravity? Is there enough evidence to believe in God? So I hope what I'm going to offer you is things that you might want to take away and ponder for days or months or years. I've been pondering this stuff for probably about 40 or 45 years now. And I hope you might too. And I hope we might get somewhere. Okay. Things are going to get complicated enough, so let's start with something simple. And the something simple is this lemon. Where did it come from? My bag. Then where did it come from? Co-op in Bookham. Then where did it come from? Well, okay, obviously we're going to get back to the lemon tree, aren't we? And where did the lemon tree come from? A lemon pip. And where did the lemon pip come from? Another lemon. And we're back to the chickens and eggs. Okay. So supposing I said this lemon was just here for no particularly good reason at all, I hope you'd all go, rubbish. And if you go home this evening and you find that your living room floor is covered in lemons, and you say to somebody, where did all the lemons come from? And they go, oh, I don't know, they're just here. You'd go, not good enough. I hope. You know, you go home, ask the kids, why is the sitting room floor covered in lemons? Oh, Mum, they're just here. No, not good enough. Okay. So we know something about lemons. You know they need a cause. They need a reason to exist. They're contingent, like tables and people and planets. And we know all of this from science. Okay, it's fairly simple science, but it's biology with the lemons and with the chickens and the eggs. So I hope what we can say is this. Everywhere where we do science, where science applies, things need reasons, explanations, causes. That's what we're trying to do to find when we do science. If we didn't think things need explaining, if they didn't need causes, we wouldn't study them with science. We might study them in other ways. We might study them in art, or we might study them in cookery, or we might write poems about them. But if we're going to do the science of them, it's because we agree they need explaining. They need a cause. So how far back can we go explaining this lemon? Okay, it came from a pip, which came from a lemon tree, which blah, 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 blah. And then we have to talk about the evolution of lemon trees. If you disagree with evolution, come back next week, because that's what we're going to talk about then. But for the moment, I'm going to presume science and presume that lemon trees evolved. So we can take that all the way back to the beginnings of life on Earth, which, according to current estimates, probably emerged about 4 billion years ago in the sea from organic chemicals, which formed on the early Earth about 4.5 billion years ago. And that came from chemical, well, sort of elements and dust and so forth that were in this part of space about 5 or 5.5 billion years ago. And those chemical elements came out of exploded stars, which would have been here a few billion years before that. And those stars were formed from the gas that came out of the Big Bang about 13.8 billion years ago. And then what was before that? Interesting question. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But before we come back to what was before the Big Bang, let's just look at what the Big Bang says, why we believe it. So the Big Bang is an explosion of matter and radiation and time and space about 13.8 billion years ago. And everything that we can see has come out of that explosion, including time and space. That's quite hard for us to get our heads around. If anyone can visualize that, then you're doing better than me. But the point is, it's not an explosion that happened somewhere in space and things were thrown out through space that was already there. It's not something that happened at a particular point in time before which the explosion hadn't gone off and it happened in time. The explosion is the beginning of time. It brings time and space into existence. Weird. Okay, it is weird. But it's important that we grasp that everything about this universe comes out of the Big Bang. Where does the theory come from? By the way, it was the theory that came first, and it was only tested by observations after the theory had been developed. The theory comes in the first place from Albert Einstein, from his general theory of relativity in 1915. And it was then his theory was sold for one or two particular cases by a guy called Alexander Friedman in 1922 and 1924. And then the more general solution was worked out by Georges Lemaître, and he realized that basically one of the ways the universe can be is emerging from what he called a primeval atom, which is now what we call the Big Bang. But the whole universe as it were, all focused down to one point all those billions of years ago. The theory came first, and people loved it because it was so mathematically elegant and it explained so much of what we can see. But the observational evidence came later. Only a little bit later, but the first piece of evidence came from Edwin Hubble, who observed distant galaxies in the universe. And what he observed famously is that the further away a galaxy is, the faster it's moving away from us. Very nearby galaxies are sort of moving all with a little bit of random motion. Some are coming towards us, some are going away. And there's still that little bit of random jiggling anywhere in the universe. But once you get a really long way away, the expansion of the universe becomes the dominant factor, and things are just all moving away from us in every conceivable direction, and the further away they are, the faster they're going. So it's a fairly simple matter, as it were, to imagine turning the clock back, and the ones that are a long way away would then be moving faster towards us, and the ones a little bit nearer us coming slightly slower towards us, but it all adds up to basically the same amount of time back to when they were all in one place. And the evidence that we've now got, having done careful measurements over nearly the last 100 years of that, it gets it down to about 13.8 billion years. First piece of evidence, and it's a pretty good piece of evidence. A second piece of evidence is the so-called microwave background radiation. This was discovered by a couple of guys called Penzias and Wilson in 1965, using that rather weird sort of horn antenna. They were trying to detect completely different sorts of signals, but whatever they used it for, there was a sort of hiss going on in the background that they couldn't get rid of, and they thought it must be a problem with their instruments or even with a detector. And you may have heard the story that at one point they thought it must be pigeon droppings in the detector. So they scraped them all out and checked everything else, and this hiss was still there. And they realized it's not a problem with their instrument. They're really detecting something. In every direction from space, there is radio hiss coming in, radio waves coming in, at about the same wavelength as the wavelength of the radiation in your microwave oven. That's why it's called microwave radiation. Not because it's named after your oven, but your oven is named after this sort of radiation. It's very cold now because the universe has been expanding for 13.8 billion years. But if you take it back, as the universe in time goes backwards and gets more compressed, it gets hotter and hotter. What it is the leftover thermal radiation from the Big Bang. The Big Bang was enormously hot, and like everything that's enormously hot, it gives off radiation. You know that fires glow red, and if you make them hotter, they grow orange and yellow and then white. And actually, if you get them even hotter, they go blue. And then ultraviolet and X-rays and all the rest of it. It's that thermal radiation from the Big Bang that's just been washing around the universe ever since then, that's just got cooler and cooler and cooler. It's dropped below visible radiation. It's dropped below the infrared that you can feel coming off your radiators in your house. It's got down to microwave level, but it's there, about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. It's coming from everywhere. More evidence for the Big Bang. A third piece of evidence, if you work out the physics of what you expect to find in the universe, the ingredients of the early universe, what you get is about 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and tiny little bits of a few other chemical elements like lithium. If you then measure the content of the first stars to form in the universe, you can do that by analyzing the light they give off, analyzing the spectrum of that light. You can work out what chemical elements are in those stars, and what you measure matches what you'd theoretically predict very closely. So again, we've got three key pieces of evidence to say that the idea of the Big Bang hangs together as a working whole. So what do scientists tell us has happened since then? Okay, well, I don't know how to draw a Big Bang, so you've just got a big sort of flashy sort of thing, and you'll just have to take my word that that's not what the Big Bang looks like. Okay, what happens? First of all, fundamental particles called quarks group together in groups of three to make protons and neutrons, and a few other things that are rather unstable and collapse fairly soon after that. All of that happens in the first millisecond after the Big Bang, the first thousandth of a second. All the quarks have combined into protons and neutrons. The protons and neutrons, then, because the universe is so hot and highly pressured, are banging into each other, and some of them are going to start sticking together to form the nuclei of other chemical elements. We just said that a minute ago, that primordial nucleosynthesis, initial making of chemical elements. So I've just given you there a little picture of a nucleus of helium. All of that stops after 20 minutes. 20 minutes after the Big Bang, the universe has got too cold for any of that to happen. It's still furiously hot, but all of those nuclear reactions have stopped. The next interesting thing to happen is after about 500,000 years, electrons combine with the atomic nuclei to form neutral atoms. At that point, the universe becomes transparent to light. Before then, light couldn't get through, so we can't see any further back. And actually, to be technically correct, that's the point at which the microwave background radiation that we can detect, that's the point it was emitted. Before that, the radiation was all sort of bouncing around inside an opaque universe. When the universe became transparent, then the radiation could start just traveling right through the universe. So from that, about just less than 500,000 years, the microwave background radiation has been traveling until someone just detected it. When you've got clouds of gas like that, gravity gets to work. So here's a cloud of gas. Okay, forgive the appalling pictures. Here's a cloud of gas, and you've got to imagine gravity beginning to pull it all together. If this cloud is just a little bit denser than the surrounding area, gravity is preferentially going to cause it to collapse downwards. And after about 100,000,000 years, we start getting the first stars forming. The clouds of gas collapse enough that they get hotter and hotter and start pulling in gas from all around them. And they get so hot because they're so compressed that nuclear reactions start happening in the middle of them and we get stars. You know things get hot when you compress them because you've used a bicycle pump and you know as you pump your bicycle pump it gets hot. Well, just imagine a whole, you know, star-sized cloud of gas getting collapsed in by gravity. It's not just going to get a bit warm, it's going to get up to millions of degrees. It's going to become a nuclear bomb. So that happens after about 100,000,000 years. In about 1,000,000 years, 1,000,000,000 years, we start getting galaxies forming. And just to bamboozle you with a few numbers, in the visible universe, we can detect about 1,000,000,000 galaxies. That's 1,000,000,000 galaxies. And each galaxy has got roughly 1,000,000,000 stars in. 1,000,000,000 stars in. So that ends up that probably in the universe we can see there are about 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, Just quite a few. Okay. As stars do the nuclear reactions inside, they haven't only got 20 minutes before the thing's expanded too much and the nuclear reactions stop. Stars keep doing those nuclear reactions for billions of years. Our sun's about 5 billion years old, and it's only about halfway through its life cycle. Initially, stars, like our sun, are burning hydrogen into helium, doing nuclear reactions to turn hydrogen into helium. And that's, roughly speaking, about as far as our sun will get. If stars are a bit bigger than our sun, then they then burn helium into carbon and oxygen and various other chemical elements. And if they're a reasonable size, then when they get to the end of their life, when they start running out of fuel, basically they explode in what's called a supernova, and all the chemical elements that they have synthesized inside get blown out into the surrounding areas of space. And then gravity gets to work again, and starts pulling all the hydrogen that's still there from the Big Bang, and all the new chemical elements made by the stars all get pulled together again and get lumpy, and you get new stars. But because you've got this richer variety of chemical elements, you can get rocky planets as well. So you get planets where interesting chemistry can happen. And I've left out a few pictures. So there's a more interesting chemical element than hydrogen or helium. There's a rocky planet forming. And there's interesting chemistry happening. And you can see what direction we're going in. A little picture of a bit of a DNA molecule there. So just as a thought, I know this is a bit corny, but other than the hydrogen atoms in your body, and apart from your soul, you're stardust. Your body was made from atoms made by an exploded star. It's quite a powerful thought. Okay, this is an amazing line of development from an utterly simple explosion to something extremely complex and beautiful. And that needs explaining. Processes of development like that don't just happen. They don't have to happen in that sort of way. Explosions don't normally produce intelligent life. Think about all the explosions you hear about on the news. They don't often end up with giraffes walking out of them. They might walk into them, but not out of them. But the explosion that started the universe has ended up with intelligent life, you and me, walking out of it. So what explains that? That, again, is a question for next week. For this week, what came before the Big Bang? What caused the Big Bang? In the classical theory of general relativity, the short answer is absolutely nothing at all. The Big Bang has to be the absolute beginning of everything. Space and time and matter and radiation and all other forms of energy, everything has to come out of the Big Bang. That's basically what made Stephen Hawking initially famous. His PhD thesis proved that if the classical Big Bang theory is true, there can be absolutely nothing before it in the universe. However, more recent theories, particularly trying to incorporate quantum theory, the theory of very small things in the world, trying to link that up with general relativity and Big Bang theory, Stephen Hawking has changed his mind. And he now thinks that there can be things before the Big Bang. So probably Einstein got almost all the way to understanding the Big Bang, but not all the way. There's more to say. It's pretty much what happens with any scientific theory. You get some of the way with one theory, and then someone cleverer or someone with more information comes along and takes the next step and the next step. So may well be there was something before the Big Bang. So something I want to warn you against is not doing arguments like this. Don't do this. The Big Bang is the beginning of the universe. At some point, it had to start to begin to exist. Anything which begins to exist has to be caused by something else. Therefore, the universe needs to be caused. Therefore, God exists. Don't do that, because the Big Bang might not be the beginning of the universe. And if it turns out not to be the beginning of the universe, we're all going to look very silly if we said that's why we believe in God. And anyway, it makes a mistake about God, because it puts God in the chronological line, as if God is sitting there for infinite ages of, la, 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 shall I make the universe yet? No, I'm not ready. Have another cup of tea. La, la, la. Oh, I think I'll make the universe now. There we go. That's a mistake about God as well. He's not something that just exists for a long time before the universe. He's completely outside time. So if we're not going to do it that way, what are we going to do? Let's come back to the lemon. You remember our lovely contingent lemon. And we know from science that anywhere things with science applies, things need explaining and causes. If they didn't, we wouldn't study them in science. Science doesn't just look for patterns. Science wants to know why things happen and how things happen. Where does the lemon come from? Where do all the various species of life come from? Why, when you pass an electric current through neon gas, does it glow that famous red colour? Or why, when you pass electric current through sodium gas, does it produce that horrible orange-yellow colour that street lamps used to be? Why? Why do we have the particular chemical elements that we've got, and so on? Science wants to find the reasons why. And it works. And our technology works. So that proves we're barking up the right tree. So, wait a minute, I'm getting ahead of myself, am I? No, I'm not. There we are. No, I am getting ahead of myself. Let's just leave that for a second. We've agreed, everywhere that science applies, things need explaining and causes. They're contingent. Okay, now we need to come to, why is there anything rather than absolutely nothing at all? We've seen that contingent beings, by definition, need an absolute being, a first cause, to explain why they're there. We had to think hard about that, but it was important. So we concluded that something must just exist without being caused, but it's not the lemon, and it's not our chickens and eggs. What is it? And I think there are three realistic possibilities. One is the universe. It's not unreasonable. So maybe the universe is just there. Or the laws of science are just there, and the laws of science make the universe. Or God is just there, and God makes everything. I can't think of any other realistic candidates. So we've got a choice of three, a trilemma, if you like. And what I want to try and do is eliminate options number one and number two. And now, one of the major discoveries of the 20th century science makes the huge impact. And that is the discovery of modern cosmology, Big Bang Theory. Because what it says, it's not just the things in the universe that obey the laws of science, but the universe as a whole obeys the laws of science. Big Bang Theory is a scientific theory of the universe. What does that mean? That means the universe is not self-explanatory. From the very fact that the scientists ask, why is the universe here? Why does it behave in the way that it does? And they can find scientific theories to answer those questions. Cosmology works. Therefore, the universe doesn't explain itself, but the universe as a whole needs to be explained. We agreed. Everywhere that science applies, things need explaining, need reasons and causes. Therefore, the universe as a whole needs to be explained. So I hope what we can do is cross out our option number one from our trilemma. Whatever else is the ultimate must just exist thing, it's not the universe, because we want to explain the universe and because we can in science. And even the atheist scientists agree with us. Richard Dawkins, you know, wrote a famous book called The God Delusion, that wanted to convince us all that God doesn't exist. And this is what he says on page 155, and I've given it you as a scanned picture because I'm not making this up. Time and again, my theologian friends returned to the point that there had to be a reason why there is something rather than nothing. There must have been a first cause of everything, and we might as well give it the name God. Yes, I said. Yes, says Richard Dawkins. So, cheap junk. But you get the point. This is important. One of the most famous books of the last 10 or 15 years, trying to convince us to be atheists, Richard Dawkins, world-famous atheist, admits on page 155 of his book that the universe needs a first cause. Okay. However, he does go on. Yes, I said, but it must have been simple,
And therefore, God is not an appropriate name.
By the way, he's a bad theologian and a bad philosopher. He doesn't know that we believe that God is simple. Even so, he's got an important point. I hope it's pretty clear that it makes sense to believe in a first cause of the universe. But is that really what we think of as God? Is it a mind? Is it personal? Or is it just an impersonal force? Is it perhaps just the laws of science that bring the universe into existence? To answer that more fully, we need to come back next week. But I just want to make a few points to begin that. First of all, just to look at the history of modern science. And what modern science has done is to link up all sorts of different phenomena. So Isaac Newton famously discovered gravity. No, he didn't. Everybody knew that when you let go of things, they fall. Isaac Newton didn't discover that apples fall. What he discovered is that the same thing that makes apples fall is what holds the moon in orbit around the Earth. There's got to be a force that pulls the moon towards the Earth, otherwise it would just go floating off into space. Why does it just keep going around the Earth? Because gravity is pulling it down. The same thing that pulled the apple down is what pulls the moon down, stops it escaping. That's what Newton discovered. And then various people like Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell linked up electricity, which we'd always known about, and magnetism, which we'd known about for years and years and years. And they realized that electricity can produce magnetism. If you pass electricity through in a coil of wire, you get a magnetic field. If you move a magnet past a coil of wire, you get an electric current. So electricity produces magnetism, and magnetism produces electricity. And electricity produces magnetism, and magnetism produces electricity. And hang on, doesn't that set off a chain reaction? Yes, it does. You can get a wave of electricity producing magnetism, producing electricity, producing magnetism, which is light. That's what light is. When you study your electricity and your magnetism, you can work out how fast that wave should go. And they worked it out, and it was the speed of light. And they went, ooh, I wonder. We discovered that light was an electromagnetic wave by studying electricity and magnetism separately and seeing how they link up. And we can link up physics to chemistry by studying how atoms work. And we can link up chemistry to life by studying how biochemistry works. We can bring it all together. How far have we got? We've got to a point now when there are basically two fundamental theories that we know of to govern the whole universe. One is general relativity, the theory that Einstein came up with, which governs basically everything that's large in the universe, stars and galaxies, and describes the way gravity works across the whole universe, space and time. And then there's quantum mechanics, which describes small things in the universe, things like how electricity works, and how nuclear physics works, and so forth. And we haven't yet worked out how to bring those two together. And it's one of the things that really annoys physicists, and they're really working on hard to try and bring those two together. And I think there's every hope of success that we'll end up with what we can call a grand unified theory. One law to describe the whole of the physical world. We haven't got there yet, but given that we've unified so much else in the universe, it looks very likely that in the end, we will manage to find one law that describes everything, a unity principle behind the whole of physical existence. But what sort of a thing is a law of science? Is it just a description of the way the universe works? Or does it actually make things happen? Is gravity just a description of what happens when I let go of this? Or does gravity make that happen? Is it a description or a cause? Scientists are not quite clear. They sort of vacillate between one and the other. If it's only a description and it doesn't cause anything, then we still need to be looking for a further cause behind the universe. And this is famously what Stephen Hawking said. Towards the end of his famous book, Brief History of Time, he said this: even if there is only one possible unified field theory, a grand unified theory, if you like, even if there's only one possible field theory, it's just a set of rules and equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Well, what's he hinting at? Surely what he's saying, we know the universe isn't the ultimate cause of everything, but he's saying if the laws of science are just descriptions, they're not the ultimate cause of anything either. So about the only thing left from our trilemma has got to be God. On the other hand, he changed his mind. And if you read a more recent book by him, The Grand Design, with a guy called Leonard Mlodinow, he says this: because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. Leaving aside the rather complicated and rather mixed up logic of the universe can and will create itself from nothing, which is sort of logically gibberish if you think it through carefully. Nothing can create itself. But the important bit is what he says at the beginning: because there is a law like gravity. He's now switched his way of thinking and thinking maybe it's the laws that cause things to happen. Gravity wasn't just a description of what happened when I let go of the lemon. Gravity made the lemon fall. The law like gravity caused it to happen. Well, if that's the case, if the laws of science cause things to happen, what are they like? They're non-material. You can't go and find the law of gravity in the under the stairs cupboard. It's not a physical thing. It's a non-material thing. It's unchanging or eternal. It applies at all times throughout the universe in the same way. It's omnipresent. It applies everywhere in the universe. It governs everything that happens in the universe. And at least according to Stephen Hawking, it can cause the whole universe to exist. And probably it's one. Now, what does that look like? Non-material, eternal, omnipresent, governing the whole universe, bringing the whole universe into existence, and one. Begins to look as if we're quite close to God. So maybe the way we resolve our trilemma is saying, okay, we agree the universe isn't the ultimate reality, the uncaused reality, but maybe the laws of science are the same thing as God. But before we get carried away, we need to come to conclusions for this week. Everyone, I hope, including scientists, especially scientists, agree that the things that we see need explaining. They need causes. And I want to say to you that once you've agreed that, it's basically all over for the atheists, isn't it? If something needs explaining, the explanation must exist. If the explanation needs explaining, you've got to keep looking for another explanation, and so on and so on. And even if you've got an infinite chain of explanations, if they all still need to be explained, you still haven't got to the end of your process. Remember the chickens and the eggs. Cosmology means that the universe needs explaining. So the universe is not the ultimate uncaused cause. So it's got to be either God or the laws of science. Or are they the same thing? But is that first cause really God? Is it personal? Does it know and love you and me? That's next week's question. Thank you very much.